From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. The Palestinian Authority joins the Israeli military in cracking down on Palestinian dissent. Then the FBI investigating women in black will speak with women from around the world in this international movement for peace. And high school students protest in Bush's backyard of Kennebunkport, Maine. All that and more coming up on the War and Peace Report. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, where the fire still burns. I'm Amy Goodman. A dispute over the Bush administration's control of information since the September 11th strikes erupted into an angry exchange between the White House and Congress yesterday after President Bush moved to restrict intelligence shared with lawmakers. Members from both parties objected strongly to Bush's highly unusual step of ordering that briefings with sensitive information be limited to 8 of the 535 members of Congress. The memo cuts off numerous lawmakers cleared to receive classified information. It was signed by Bush on Friday following a report in the Washington Post that intelligence officials told lawmakers there was a 100% likelihood of further terrorist strikes. Meanwhile, CNN has complied with a U.S. government demand that they not play another message from an ally of Osama bin Laden on videotape, like the one played several days ago by CNN and Al Jazeera network around the world. CNN explained it's because the government's concerned there may be a hidden message in the videotape to terrorists. The concern, though, is it's the overt message they're concerned with, and that is the playing of this videotape and the effect it has on the Muslim world. U.S. forces launched air attacks on Afghanistan for the fourth straight day today. At a Pentagon news conference yesterday, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said the strikes had damaged air defenses in Afghanistan to the point that U.S. and British raids could be flown around the clock with minimal concern about threats. The Taliban said this morning one cruise missile hit a residential area in Kabul last night, killing civilians and destroying houses. The Taliban also said that in response to the U.S. bombing raid, they'd lifted all restrictions on Osama bin Laden and were urging him to wage a holy war on the U.S. Bin Laden's spokesperson issued a televised appeal yesterday for Muslims around the world to rise in a global holy war against the United States and its interests everywhere. It's that videotape that CNN has said it will not play. In a news conference with German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, President Bush declined to offer any clues to the next phase of the bombing campaign, brushing aside questions about whether the United States is preparing to introduce ground troops into the conflict in Afghanistan. He said, "I'm not going to tell you." But according to today's New York Times, two senior Pentagon officials say the Pentagon is preparing to launch risky raids into Afghanistan using low-flying Army helicopter gunships. At the same time, the administration is deploying a growing number of special forces to the region, including troops in Uzbekistan. Bush also said the war will continue for as long as necessary, whether it takes one day, one month, one year, or one decade. When asked about a statement from the Pakistani president, who said on Monday he had been assured the military campaign would be brief, President Bush replied, "I don't know who told the Pakistan president that." The War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has said that people should prepare for a war like the Cold War. The Bush administration warned Saddam Hussein this week that the United States would launch military strikes against Iraq if he tried to assist anti-American forces in Afghanistan or move against his domestic opponents during the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations John Negroponte personally delivered the message to Iraq's senior U.N. envoy at the Iraqi mission Sunday, shortly after the United States launched airstrikes against Afghanistan. According to a U.N. diplomat, Negroponte told the Iraqi envoy, "There will be a military strike against you, and you will be defeated." Street protests swelled around the world against the U.S. war in Afghanistan. In Manila, protesters denounced the Filipino president, Gloria Arroyo, for supporting the U.S. They staged a rally in front of the U.S. embassy, carrying banners saying no to U.S.-led war and justice, not war, and displayed an effigy of Uncle Sam holding a missile to the head of a child. In Khartoum, Sudanese Islamic scholars and hundreds of demonstrators marched through the streets and gathered in front of the presidential palace, where leaders made fiery speeches and condemned the war on Afghanistan as one against Islam before police fired tear gas to disperse them. In Jakarta, Indonesians staged protests for a third day at the tightly guarded U.S. embassy. Students carried placards reading "Save Afghanistan, Save the World from Global Terrorism, and Drag Bush to an International Tribunal." In Athens, some 4,000 Greek anti-war protesters marched against what organizers called an imperialist war, Americans murderers of peoples. In Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia's Islamic population opposition party declared a jihad or holy war over U.S.-led attacks and gave the go-ahead for its members to join the fight. In Bangkok, hundreds of Thai Muslims protested outside the U.S. embassy, calling for an end to U.S.-led attacks in Afghanistan and solidarity among Muslims to reject the strikes. In Berlin, pacifists delivered a 20,000-signature petition to the foreign ministry, calling on the German government to avoid getting involved in military action in Afghanistan. And in Brisbane, Australia, police arrested 6 people in an anti-war protest outside the recruiting center of Australia's Defense Department. War, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat is facing a storm of criticism after Palestinian police killed 2 Palestinians, including a 12-year-old boy, wounded at least 200 in demonstrations yesterday in the Gaza Strip, protesting the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Arafat's government took 2 unprecedented steps, closing Gaza City's universities to silence Islamic critics and barring foreign reporters from the Gaza Strip to prevent coverage of the events. Osama bin Laden's videotaped message on Sunday, which said the U.S. would not be secure until the people of Palestine are secure, helped to spark the demonstrations by elements of the Islamic group Hamas. The move comes as the Palestinian president spoke today at an emergency meeting of foreign ministers of the Organization of the Islamic Conference in Qatar, calling for international action to rid the world of terrorism. Arafat also told the ministers gathered there that Israel was taking advantage of last month's attacks in the United States to launch new offensives against Palestinians. Israeli troops have killed at least 27 Palestinians since Arafat and the Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres reached a tentative ceasefire more than a week ago. We go now to Bassem Eid, who is the director of the Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Project. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Where are you right now?
I am in East Jerusalem right now at our offices.
Can you explain exactly what is happening in Gaza?
Yeah, unfortunately, as you mentioned that last Monday, there was a demonstration organized by students, university in Gaza Strip. According to the testimony that we collected from some witnesses, it was a completely peaceful demonstration. And that demonstration took place on the occasion to support the bin Laden, terror activities. And a clash started between the demonstrators and the Palestinian police. And later on, the Palestinian police started shooting by using live bullets towards the demonstrators, which as a result of that, two Palestinians were killed and around 100 Palestinians get injured.
And what about the crackdown on the press, that the press can't go to Gaza City? How unprecedented is this?
I think that that President Arafat right now is between the international community hammer and the Palestinian people anvil, which he couldn't satisfy the both sides in the same time. There is a huge pressure on Arafat, you know, that is such kind of support in bin Laden, just harassing the reputation of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian Authority, which I completely agree with. And on the other side, Arafat couldn't also stop, you know, such kind of a storm of support of some of the Palestinians in bin Laden activities. So in term to decrease the international pressure on Arafat, I think that it was a wise order from him to prevent the entrance of any foreign journalist to the territories, which it looks like that Arafat is just continue oppressing the freedom of press. But on the other side, the Palestinian security forces also couldn't protect, in the meantime, the foreign journalists while they are entering to the occupied territories, especially into the Gaza Strip.
What about this issue of protesters, as the articles describe it, also protesting Yasser Arafat? How much is that contributing to the crackdown?
See, no doubt that the Palestinian community, including some Palestinian officials, of course, the Palestinian civil society community criticized the incidents which took place in last Monday in Gaza, because we believe as a human rights organizations that any excessive force shouldn't have to be used against a peaceful demonstrators everywhere, not only in Gaza Strip. And I think that the Palestinian Authority must have to find, you know, a kind of other tools to oppress these demonstrations rather than to start shooting live bullets towards the Palestinians. When a Palestinian kid, you know, who is 14 years old, killed by the Palestinian police, I think that the Palestinians should have to look much more deeply in their internal troubles rather than, you know, to focus all the time on the Israeli violations which committed by the Israelis every day.
We're talking to Bassem Eid, director of the Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Project in East Jerusalem. We were just watching CNN, where they said they've complied with a government demand that they not run the spokesperson of Osama bin Laden on another videotape calling for a jihad. And they said the reason they've complied with this, they did run the Osama bin Laden videotape, is because there might be a hidden message as giving a go-ahead to terrorists to attack something else. What do you think of this? Or do you think it has more to do with just the effect of the Osama bin Laden videotape being played around the world?
See, really, I don't know exactly how all of these videotapes, you know, comes to the region here. I don't know through whom these cassettes are coming, And what I am complaining on is just, you know, not to put the Palestinians all the time as a reason on what's going on here in the region. The Palestinian people is just a part, you know, of a huge world. And I think that such kind of demonstrations or activities or supporting terror, it's not only going on among a few groups of Palestinians, but it's also all over the world. We saw also in some other Arab countries that there was demonstrations and there were a huge support in Bin Laden. I think that the Palestinians should have to be a much more understanding again among the international community. The Palestinians are so upset, so frustrated, so angry on what's going on against them in the last 1 year. And unfortunately, in the whole violations committed by the Israelis in the last year, more than 600 Palestinians were killed, over than 600 houses were demolished. No, the international community didn't try to show any kind of support towards the Palestinians or the Palestinian people in terms to decrease, you know, the Israeli violations against them. So they are feeling so isolated from the world, so lonely, which that's giving them the opportunity, you know, to revenge today from the international community because they kept silence in the last 1 year.
I want to bring Gila Sversky into this conversation. She is a member of Women in Black and co-founder of the Coalition of Women for a Just Peace. Also, has been executive director of Bat Shalom, which means Daughters of Peace, and Bet Salem. What about your take on what's happening now with Gaza University being closed, Gaza being closed to the press, and just what Bassem Eid has been describing from East Jerusalem?
Well, first let me pay my respects to Bassem Eid, who is a colleague in the human rights business, and we have worked together in the past. I have deep respect for his work and his courage. What is going on in Gaza was correctly characterized by Bassem. It places Arafat in a very difficult position of, on the one hand, having to placate the pressure from the United States, placate American pressure, and on the other hand, being responsive to Palestinians who want to exercise freedom of speech and have every right to do so. Let me just say that every single Palestinian I've spoken with condemns the terrorist actions that took place in the United States on September 11th. And yet, I would still like to hear a clear voice from Palestinian leadership, and Arafat in particular, condemning that terrorism. I am not asking for support for the American bombing of Afghanistan. I myself do not support that, and I would not like to hear people of integrity support it. On the other hand, I would like to hear clear enunciation of condemnation for the kind of terrorism that took place on September 11th.
Right now, Bassem Eid, with the attacks on Afghanistan, do you think that Yasser Arafat faces a threat to his leadership?
No, I don't think that Arafat is facing any threats right now from the attack on Afghanistan. I think that the incident which happened 2 days ago in Gaza, it might have, you know, the positive, let's say, face and the negative face. The negative face that the Palestinian Authority or the Palestinian police opened fire towards peaceful demonstrators. On the other side, the most positive face of that incident, that it's showing how much Arafat is really willing to implement the ceasefire between the Palestinians and the Israelis. I think that most of the Israeli leadership after that incident last Monday in Gaza, most of them already stated out and they declared and they recognized, let's say, the efforts which Arafat really trying to put in turn to reach a complete ceasefire. So if that ceasefire will take place and that ceasefire will implement it, no doubt that there was no threats towards Arafat at all as the leader of the Palestinians. But if that ceasefire will not going to be implemented by the both sides, then I can imagine in which trouble Arafat is going to get in.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to ask you, Bassem Eid, about the U.S. holding out the threat of force against Iraq and what this would mean for the people of the West Bank and Gaza. We're talking to Bassem Eid, who is head of the Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Project, also on the line with us from Jerusalem, is Gila Svirsky, a Women in Black member. And then we're going to talk about Women in Black and the FBI in interrogating some of its members. We'll speak with the folk singer Ronnie Gilbert, who is a member of Women in Black in California, as well as a member here in New York. We'll then be going up to Maine to talk about high school protests outside the Bush compound in Kennebunkport. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now! in Exile. I'm Amy Goodman, and the burning smell persists, sometimes gets even stronger in this area. Still police checkpoints at the end of the road as they stop cars and vans and trucks. There's National Guard and police just outside the firehouse that we're broadcasting from. On the line with us, Gila Svirsky, Women in Black member in Jerusalem, co-founder of the Coalition of Women for Just Peace, and Bassem Eid, director of the Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Project. In the last days, the Bush administration warning Saddam Hussein that the United States would launch military strikes against Iraq if he tries to assist anti-American forces in Afghanistan or move against his domestic opponents during the U.S. bombing raid against Afghanistan. What is your comment on that and what this means for Palestinians?
Yeah, I'm a person who is completely against, you know, any kind of war here. I will never be against resisting against terror in this world. But don't forget that in the case when a war takes place between two countries, I don't want the civilians to be the victims of that war or that conflict. And I saw yesterday, or probably this morning, when some American missiles hit a neighborhood in Afghanistan, that some civilians were killed and some houses were demolished. It's also reminding me during the Gulf War in 91, where so many Iraqi civilians were killed during that war. And I just would like to tell you that in 95 I visited Iraq, and I saw exactly in which situation the Iraqis children are living in. I think that the American people, I want to call here the American people, not the American administration, that the American people should have to take in their mind the suffering of the civilians in these countries, either Afghanistan or Iraq, and to try to put more and more pressure on their own administration to keep far away from the neighborhoods and from civilians, in turn to show that really the United States or any other country would like here to resist against terror and not to revenge also from the civilians in that country.
Bassemid, what kind of personal risk do you face right now?
No, I'm really not facing any kind of risk right now. I think that this is my my position is to fulfill the need of the people and not the greed of the government.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Bassem Eid, Director of the Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Project in East Jerusalem. I'm going to ask Gila Sversky to remain on the line as we continue on the issue of women in black. Every Wednesday evening for the past few weeks, a group of women has gathered in front of the New York Public Library in Midtown Manhattan, dressed in all black as a symbol of mourning for victims of war, standing silently. Because, as one member said, words cannot express the tragedy that wars and hatred bring. Their group is Women in Black, an international movement which began in Israel in 1988, a month after the beginning of the first Palestinian Intifada. Once a week at the same hour and in the same location, a major traffic intersection, a small group of Israeli women donned black clothing and raised a black sign in the shape of a hand with white lettering that read, "Stop the occupation." The idea spread quickly and spontaneously to other places in Israel and a few months later all over the world. Today, we're going to speak with Women in Black in a number of places around the world, including one who's being investigated by the FBI for her membership. We're going to start with a woman in Berkeley, Kate Raphael, who is with Women in Black and was approached by the FBI. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Kate.
Thank you.
When were you approached and why did they question you?
I got a phone call on September 24th. I actually got a voicemail when I came home from work and from an agent of the FBI saying that she wanted to ask me some questions and would I please call her back. I was quite surprised, among other reasons, because we don't think of the FBI leaving voicemails. I mean, you think of the FBI showing up at your door or something. So I thought about it and decided that I didn't want to call her back. I had an attorney from the National Lawyers Guild call her and find out what she wanted. And much to our surprise, she said she wanted to talk to me about September 11th because of my involvement with Women in Black. She did say that Women in Black is not a target of the investigation. That is, they don't consider that we are suspects in this investigation. And I think that's important because it's not strictly true that Women in Black is being investigated. What is true is that in their investigation, the sort of random nature of their fishing expedition has, for some reason, caught up with Women in Black and myself. I asked my attorney to convey to her that I wasn't really interested in talking to her. Before that, as soon as my attorney called her back, she left me another message saying that I was welcome to come in with my attorney, but that if I didn't do that, she would probably have me subpoenaed to a grand jury. She wasn't supposed to make that phone call. After they've been told that you're represented by counsel, they're not supposed to call you directly. They're supposed to call your attorney. And it seemed to me that she really wanted to deliver that threat of a grand jury subpoena, which most people who understand the situation believe is an empty threat and just intended to intimidate me into talking to her, that she wanted to deliver that in person rather than through my attorney. And the next day when my attorney called her back and asked if she would give a list of the questions that she wanted to ask me, she immediately said that no, she was reporting me non-cooperative to the people in New York and would see if they wanted to issue a subpoena, which they have not done. To this date, I haven't had further contact with them.
We're also joined on the phone from California by Ronnie Gilbert, well known for her singing, being a part of the Weavers, today an activist in the Bay Area. And Ronnie, you have written a letter that has circulated around the internet about the FBI investigation.
Yeah, when I heard this story, Kate and I are in different groups, different women in black groups in the Bay Area. I thought, wow, I have been here before. this is, you know, combined with all the information or all the statements in the press, and that we're going to have to curtail our civil rights. I thought, what? They're starting with women in black. This has really gone further than I thought it was. So I did. I wrote what I meant, what was meant to be a an op-ed piece for the newspaper, and sent it out. And then somebody picked it up and sent it out on the internet.
Could you read some of it to us?
Sure. Well, let's see, where do I start? For the second time in my life, at least, a group that I belong to is being investigated by the FBI. The first was the Weavers. And then I go on to explain what the Weavers were, for those who can't, who didn't know, that we were an industry phenomenon in 1950, having recorded a couple of songs from our American World folk music repertoire, Lead Belly's Goodnight Irene, and ironically, the Israeli Tzena Tzena Tzena, and sold millions of records. In 1952, 2 years later, the whole thing was over. The record company dropped us. Television producers stopped knocking on the door. The Weavers were on a private, yet very well-publicized roster of suspected entertainment industry reds. And the FBI came a-calling. And I just found out that Women in Black, another group of peace activists I belong to, is the subject of an FBI investigation. And I go on to explain what Women in Black is about, and which I you have already done quite well, Amy. And then I say, if the FBI cannot or will not distinguish between groups who collude in hatred and terrorism and peace activists who struggle in the full light of day against all forms of terrorism, we are in serious trouble. And I've seen that trouble before. It was called McCarthyism. In the hysterical atmosphere in the early Cold War, anyone who had signed a peace petition, who had joined an organization opposing violence or racism, or had tried to raise money for refugee children of the Spanish Civil War, in other words, anyone who had openly advocated what wasn't popular at the time was fair game. In my case, the FBI visited the Weaver's booking agent, the recording company, my neighbors, my dentist husband's patients, my friends. In the waning of our career, the Weavers were followed down the street, accosted on stage by drunken patriots, warned by friendly hotel employees to keep the door open if we rehearsed in anyone's room, so as not to become targets for the vice squad. It was quite nasty. Every two-bit local wannabe G-man joined the dragnet, searching out and identifying communist spies. In all those self-debasing years, how many spies were pulled in by that dragnet? Nary a one. Instead, it pulled down thousands of teachers, union members, scientists, journalists, actors, entertainers like us, who saw our lives disrupted, our jobs, careers go down the drain, our standing in the community lost, even our children harassed. And a scared population soon shut their mouths up tight. And thus came the silence of the 1950s and early 60s, when no notable voice of reason was heard to say, hey, wait a minute, look what we're doing to ourselves, to the land of the free and the home of the brave. Not one dissenting intelligence was allowed a public voice to warn against zealous foreign policies we'd later come to regret, would be regretting now if our leaders were honest. Today, in the wake of the worst hate crime in the millennium, a dragnet is out for terrorists, and we are told that certain civil liberties may have to be curtailed for our own security. Well, which ones? I'm curious to know. the First Amendment guarantee of freedom of speech or the press, the right of people peaceably to assemble. Well, haven't I been here before? Hysterical neo-McCarthyism does not equal security, never will. The bitter lesson September 11th's horrific tragedy should have taught us and our government is that only an honest reevaluation of our foreign policies and careful, focused, and intelligent intelligence work can hope to combat operations like the one that robbed all of us and their families of 6,000 decent working people. We owe the dead that, at least. As for women in black, we definitely intend to keep on keeping on.
Ronnie Gilbert, still singing that song in all different ways for freedom. Ronnie Gilbert talking to us from the Bay Area, once a member of the Weavers, as we talk about women in black being investigated by the FBI. Also on the line with us, one of the founders of Women in Black in Israel, who has been describing the situation there now in light of the bombing in Afghanistan, but also here with us to talk about the situation in Iraq. And we're joined in the studio in New York by another member of Women in Black, Andira Kajasovic, who comes from Belgrade. One quick question to Gila Svirsky in Jerusalem, and that is, you hear about the FBI and Women in Black here. In what way has Israeli intelligence, or have they, been dealing with Women in Black there?
Women in Black have never been popular in Israel because we oppose the consensus, which is occupation, or at least it's the consensus of the ruling powers here, whichever government has been in power. We oppose it because we oppose all oppression of one people by another. Ronnie Gilbert put it into very good context when she talked about the McCarthyism of the activity of persecuting those who call the system, those who would subvert the powers against oppressed peoples. We are very much outspoken in what we say. What we say is, in the occupation does nobody any good. It does not do the Palestinians any good. It does not do the Israelis any good. In fact, we go further, and we say that all violence is wrong, and that includes the violence of war, and that includes the United States and its coalition attacks on the Afghani government and anyone else it chooses to attack. Violence simply begets more violence. Violence, in turn, fosters counter-violence. Therefore, we in Women in Black throughout Israel, all of our vigils, have come out strongly, publicly, in demonstrations and in ads and newspapers, saying, no more attack on Afghanistan. No more attack on anyone. It's not right now a popular position, perhaps not in the United States either, but it's a position that we as Women in Black have taken consistently over the years. That it's regarded as subversive is true. We are subversive. We're subversive of a military-industrial complex that sees war as the answer. We see peace as the answer. We see negotiation as the answer. We feel that the only true security can be achieved by having a just peace.
And that question of you, Israeli intelligence and Women in Black?
We are all, I'm sure, have thick files in the Israeli intelligence services. We're used to that. Every time we go out to demonstrations against the actions of the Israeli government, we are filmed by video cameras of the intelligence services. They don't hide it. We don't hide it when we smile into the camera. We're proud about what we're doing. We do it openly. We don't do it secretly. We state our views. We don't do anything to undermine the powers other than express ourselves publicly. We do encourage people to resist service in army service, in the service of occupation. We do that openly. If they choose to arrest us for it, and they have arrested me on several occasions for all sorts of things, I willingly go. Because it's an opportunity to speak my piece.
Gila Sversky, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, along with Ronnie Gilbert in the Bay Area, both women in black. And then we'll come back to our guest in the studio, who comes from Belgrade, and she's a member of Women in Black here. You are listening to the Democracy Now! in Exile War and Peace Report. In our second hour, we're going to be taking an in-depth look at the Northern Alliance that the U.S. is supporting right now and what their human rights record is, along with coming up in this hour, high school students who are protesting in the Bush compound backyard in Kennebunkport, Maine. Stay with us.
Lord, must I do unto others before they do unto me? Must I arm myself to protect myself from harm and injury? Oh, no, that is not the lesson that I learned on my mother's knee when she told me to do unto others only what I have them do unto me.
Sweet Honey in the Rock Prayer here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, as we talk about Women in Black and the FBI questioning this organization founded in Israel at the beginning of the Intifada in 1988. On the line with us, Ronnie Gilbert, the folk singer from the Bay Area, Gila Sversky, one of the founders of Women in Black in Jerusalem, and Indira Kajasovich, a member of Women in Black in New York, originally from Belgrade. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Indira.
Thank you for inviting us all.
What about why you joined Women in Black and what you're doing here in New York with this organization?
I would like to say that I have been with Women in Black for 10 years. First time was on October 9 in 1991. It was the beginning of the time when Milosevic started to get more engaged in Croatia, and when Serbia and the Yugoslav army started to work in that area and actually to bomb certain places in Croatia and in Bosnia. So Women in Black from Belgrade were among a brave group of women who stand in violence in a big public square like everywhere else. And it has been really something very special for every single person who have been involved in a very nonviolent movement, just offering their bodies and standing in silence in a public square in various places around the world. And there are groups all over the place, and I would like actually to say several things about how various states have dealt with Women in Black. And nowadays, something that you might have mentioned before, I haven't heard it, Women in Black of Israel and Women in Black of Belgrade on behalf of the Women in Black movement have been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, which is really a tremendous acknowledgement of this, just a group of women standing in a bigger public space, that they become the threat to the governments, whatever governments are and wherever they come. And it has been very important to have people like Ronnie, who can also say this thing beautifully, who can also make connections when the government start really cutting down on the basic human rights, including the human rights to gather in a big public spaces like this one. And you were the other day at that demonstration on Sunday. Wasn't it amazing to have 12,000 people and then not to have any report on the television about that? There were all kind of groups. And this is New York City. This is where the media is being made. And we don't have those reports out there. It's very important to keep talking about civil liberties in this country, but it's also very important to know that this is not the first time. As Gila Sversky has said, in places like Jerusalem or Belgrade, Women in Black lived this. We have made a conscious decision in 1993 that even if we do have infiltrators to you know, just not even do anything against, not to go into the who is the spy among us, who is doing this or who is doing that. And last year, it was very, very powerful for me to hear, to have a government of Israel from the Serbian government, from the Yugoslav government. I was in a position trying to get somebody in the country, and it was namely a famous actress who wanted to go into visit refugee camps. So the government, the embassy was not issuing a visa. And I spoke to the government representative, and we had a very long, a very nice chat. And she said, well, you know, this is the time when that vicious group of women in black has regular conferences, and we don't want any foreigners to come. The vicious group of women in black is a bunch of women, a dozen, sometimes 50, sometimes 100. And in August of every year, they have met for, this has been the 10th meeting, this year was the 10th anniversary, in Novi Sad, or it was in Ulcinj, and last year was the only year when they actually didn't allow 250 peace activists from all over the, around the world to meet.
Women in Black, a group of women around the world, in the studio with us, Andira Kajosevic, who comes from Belgrade, is here now. As the attacks happened on the World Trade Center, now the attacks in Afghanistan, your own city, Belgrade, was bombed by NATO forces. What was your original response?
My response was a great sadness for these people who have lost their lives. That was my first immediate reaction. It was impossible to walk around the city of Manhattan and to feel that there have been so many people who died in 15 minutes. This is terrible, what the civilization has come through, to be able to kill in such a short period of time so many people. And this is something, as people, we should ask ourselves, how do we allow this terrible weapons to develop more and more, and are not capable to stop this kind of terrible happenings that occur. It was the first reaction. The second reaction, I work with people who come from former Yugoslavia. We run a community center in Long Island City. The first call I got a call from a woman who was on 80th floor, who is from Belgrade, whose children actually watched on the television, on the school television, how the plane was going straight into the place where she works. And of course, kids are terrified. They came from Belgrade, from in the middle of bombing of Belgrade. So here they are, now expecting for more bombs to come in. And of course, they have all kinds of things to work on in that respect, to be able to live their life normally. And these are regular people, and this is why Women in Black stand and take a stand.
Ronnie Gilbert, we just heard Andira describe how the media does very little coverage of the peace movement and Women in Black in particular. From your experience of years of, I guess you could say, monitoring or surveillance, as you talked about the McCarthy era, do you find that being high profile protects you? If the media were to cover these groups, that they'd be less infiltrated or monitored?
I don't really know, Amy. I think for me, the most important thing, the lesson of the 50s, was to be more open than you ever thought you could be. Just stand out there and say, here we are. And that's why I was so attracted to Women in Black. Stand out there right in the open and say, look, this is the inevitable result of violence. Mourning, women mourning for their children, for their loved ones, for, you know, this is the inevitable thing. Stand out there, no matter who says what. I love what this woman says. I just love it that they didn't worry about spies in the group. They just, you want to come join us? Come join us. Be there, you know. The problem of not getting a coverage in the media is a real problem, but I don't know how that is overcome except by people like you, Amy, who get out there and do whatever you can. We're not covered. I mean, there was a beautiful demonstration here. My group put on a demonstration at what's called Tashlik, the casting of our sins and our sorrows into the water. It's part of the Days of Awe celebration at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and it was gorgeous. A truck came by from one of the stations. I think it was maybe Channel 7 or something like that. Took a look and went away. They did nothing about it, you know. We would like to have had people see who we are and what we are and to join us. But of course, whoever controls what goes on the air, thought it's not sexy enough, I guess.
Well, on Fox in New York, there was almost a report of the peace protest. They said coming up, and they had pictures of the protests. They just never came up. That report just never happened to air. I want to thank you all for being with us. If people want to get in touch with Women in Black, is there a website or phone number that they can go to? Andira?
There are several websites, just because every single group in any parts of the world is autonomous, and they also do their own publicizing of the events. The website that we have put together here in New York is http://womeninblack.net. So it's one word, womeninblack.net. And that's the easy way. And I have to say that although we didn't really have much coverage, it has been really tremendous to see how many people want to get involved. And I do think that that's the one thing that Americans are really good at. When they do want to do something, they do. They don't really listen to their government.
Well,
if I could also give my own email address, because we, out of Israel, are running an international network for people who are either Women in Black vigils throughout the world or would like to get information about it. My email address is G Svirsky, that's all one word, G-S-V-I-R-S-K-Y, at netvision, all one word, .net.il.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Gila Svirsky, for being with us from Jerusalem, Andira Kajosevich from New York and Belgrade, and Ronnie Gilbert joining us from the Bay Area. Before that, Kate Raphael, also with Women in Black in Berkeley, talking about her experience with the FBI. And you are listening to the War and Peace Report as we go to our last segment. In recent days, tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets of major cities of Europe, the Middle East, and Asia to protest the U.S. and British airstrikes against Afghanistan. Largely under the radar screen of the corporate media, people in hundreds of communities around the United States are also organizing demonstrations, vigils, and teach-ins to protest the bombings. Yesterday, we spoke to people in Olympia, Washington, about the ways they're organizing since September 11th. Today, we go to Kennebunk, Maine, where local high school students just held their first anti-war demonstration. David Morgan's on the line with us from Kennebunk High School, along with Scott Rose. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! in Exile. David Morgan, can you talk about what you did yesterday?
Sure. It was basically a group of friends and I who organized everything. We gathered about 40 people, and we met downtown Kennebunk and marched to our town hall, carrying signs and gathering some attention. I was really surprised by the attraction of the media to our cause. We were definitely covered, especially in the local papers. At the town hall, we had speeches and a film that Preston Edmonds, a friend of mine who's looking to break into the film industry soon, had put together. And that covered basically accounts of war from the Vietnam era and also some accounts from the New York City tragedy, as well as Washington.
Scott, why did you decide to help organize this protest?
I really can't take credit for helping organize. This is very much Dave's brainchild, and he did a fabulous job putting this together. But I did agree to speak because
Can you speak as loud as you can?
I'm sorry, yeah. I can't take credit at all for organizing the rally. That was Dave's brainchild. He did a fabulous job with it. But I did agree to speak because I think that there's a lot of... there's a real need for people to be thinking in times of crisis level-headedly instead of following our administrative leaders, without a lot of consideration.
David, what made you decide to organize this? Was it your first anti-war protest?
Yeah, it was. My major directive for getting everything organized was watching the automatic military response that our government met these atrocities with.
And what about the fact that this is in the Bush family's backyard, this protest?
I think that's really just coincidence. We didn't really give much thought to that before we organized everything.
Do you think that brought out the press?
Possibly.
They didn't really mention it.
Yeah. The first time that I had heard reference to Bush being in our area was from Common Dreams on their website.
Do you understand how much protests are going on around the country? Did you have a sense of that?
We didn't really until after the fact. I think that this really was just a small-scale thing until we were met with such enthusiasm, really. We saw thousands of people in support of it through the internet and through media of many different types.
And how did your school respond?
I'd say it was a fairly beneficial thing to have most of the kids at school on our side.
A lot of spoken support, but for this first rally, I don't know if it was just because it was Columbus Day and people were doing other things, but the turnout wasn't quite what we hoped from the student population.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Will you continue to protest?
Peace is looking for alternatives. And so that's what Dave and I are doing. We're hoping next to do some sort of an open forum, a discussion on the Bush response and the American response.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Scott Rose and David Morgan, both seniors at Kennebunk High School in Maine. And that does it for today's program. I want to thank everyone who wrote in and let us know what you're doing in your community. Please keep sending those emails at mail@democracynow.org and let us know how you're watching or listening to the War and Peace Report. We're on public access around the country. We're on Dish Network Channel 9415 on Free Speech TV. We're here in New York at Manhattan Neighborhood Network on Channel 34 and 56, Monday through Friday, 9 until, well, almost 11. And on community radio stations, Pacific affiliates around the country, as well as KPFA. And we thank KPFA very much, Aaron Glantz and Amy Pomerleau, for that. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland's at the helm at WBIX.org with Kareem Katkuda. You can hear us at democracy@webactive.com, and you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to our tech team at the New York Independent Media Center, Noel Rabinowitz, Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Karen Renucci, Didi Halleck, Lenny Charles, Rachel Jones, Orlando Richards, Rob Weiss, Tom Poole. Thank you to them as well. In broadcasting from In Exile, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile.
Fast Track Trade Promotion Authority will facilitate the passage of the Free Trade Area of the Americas, FTA, which will devastate working people, condemning them to more misery, exploitation, and poverty.
Trading on Tragedy, Fast Track, the Trade Promotion Authority bill, moves swiftly through Congress. And the U.S. lends military and financial support to the Northern Alliance, the opposition group to the Taliban. But Human Rights Watch warns they've also committed serious human rights abuses. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. forces launched air attacks on Afghanistan for the fourth straight day today. At a Pentagon news conference, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said the strikes had damaged air defenses in Afghanistan to the point that U.S. and British raids could be flown around the clock with minimal concern about threats. The Taliban said this morning that one cruise missile hit a residential area in Kabul last night, killing civilians and destroying houses. The Taliban also said in response to the U.S. bombing raids, they'd lifted all restrictions on bin Laden and were urging him to wage a holy war on the U.S. Bin Laden's spokesperson issued a televised appeal yesterday for Muslims around the world to rise in a global holy war against the United States and its interests everywhere. Unlike the videotape of Osama bin Laden that was played around the world on Sunday, just after the announcement by President Bush that the bombing had begun, the videotape of Osama bin Laden's spokesperson will not be aired by CNN. They said that they made an agreement with the U.S. government that they would not let people hear his words. They said that the government told him that there might be a hidden message that is a code to terrorists in the world. The serious question is whether it's a hidden message or the fact that airing Osama bin Laden's words got play around the world with newspapers printing side by side the text of President Bush's speech and the text of Osama bin Laden's message, and they didn't want that to happen again. In a news conference with German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, President Bush declined to offer any clues to the next phase of the bombing, brushing aside questions about whether the United States is preparing to introduce ground troops into the conflict in Afghanistan. He said, "I'm not going to tell you." But according to the New York Times today, two senior Pentagon officials say the Pentagon is preparing to launch risky raids into Afghanistan using low-flying Army helicopter gunships. At the same time, the administration's deploying a growing number of special forces to the region, including troops in Uzbekistan. President Bush also said the war will continue for as long as necessary, whether, quote, it takes one day, 1 month, 1 year, or one decade. When asked about a statement from the Pakistani President Musharraf, who said on Monday he'd been assured the military campaign would be brief, President Bush replied, "I don't know who told the Pakistan president that." The Bush administration warned Saddam Hussein this week that the United States will launch military strikes against Iraq if he tries to assist anti-American forces in Afghanistan or move against his domestic opponents. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, John Negroponte, personally delivered the message to Iraq's senior U.N. envoy at the Iraqi mission Sunday, shortly after the United States launched airstrikes against Afghanistan. According to a U.N. diplomat, Negroponte told the Iraqi envoy, "There will be a military strike against you, and you will be defeated." A dispute over the Bush administration's control of information since the September 11th strikes erupted into an angry exchange between the White House and Congress yesterday after President Bush moved to restrict intelligence shared with lawmakers. Members from both cities, from both parties, objected strongly to Bush's highly unusual step of ordering that briefings with sensitive information be limited to 8 of the 535 members of Congress. The memo cuts off numerous lawmakers cleared to receive classified information. It was signed by Bush on Friday following a report in the Washington Post that intelligence officials told lawmakers there was 100% likelihood of further terrorist strikes. And investigators caution that tests confirming that the bacteria strain was manufactured are not complete, but a positive match would mean the strain was man-made and would move the case closer to a criminal investigation. CNN is reporting that investigators believe the anthrax strain that killed a man in Florida was manufactured at a facility in Iowa half a century ago. Robert Stevens, a supermarket tabloid photo editor, died of inhalation of anthrax on Friday, and a second employee at the newspaper's Boca Raton offices has tested positive for exposure to anthrax. When the anthrax strain was produced in the 1950s, sources told CNN, scientists were working to create it artificially for research purposes, but what happened over the years that would end with its reappearance in a Florida newspaper building is the mystery that investigators have yet to solve. A British government official traveling with Prime Minister Tony Blair said no other country would be attacked without absolute evidence that it sponsored terrorism and without the widest international support for military action. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright cautioned the Bush administration yesterday to keep the focus of the war on terrorism on Afghanistan. In a speech at University of Southern California, she said attacks on other countries would risk losing the support of the coalition of governments that President Bush has assembled since last month's terrorist attacks. And the Chinese foreign minister said China is also opposed to U.S. military strikes spreading from Afghanistan to other countries. Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, is the person who answered in response to a question by Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes whether the price was worth 500,000 Iraqi children dead. She was talking about sanctions. Madeleine Albright responded, the price was worth it.
How many miles must we march for freedom? How many wars will we have to bear before our homeless have a world that feeds them? Before our children have a world that cares? We are one. We are one.
Before the lonely don't live life in silence, without a gentle place to rest their hearts. How many men will we let stroll by us, asking for money in the name of God? Oh, we are one. Yeah, it's true. We are one.
We are one from One World Tribe here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast just blocks from where the World Trade Center once stood. Now, at least somewhere around 6,000 people are buried there. The numbers are still not clear. As we have repeated over the last days, not only the numbers that the government is talking about now, but the many unaccounted for undocumented workers. Companies won't come forward because they are concerned about being sanctioned for employing undocumented workers, and families afraid to come forward to name who was there because they're concerned about the close relationship between the police and the INS. Well, while much of the U.S. media lauds the Taliban opposition group, the Northern Alliance, as heroic, human rights and women's groups are saying that their record is anything but clean. After the September 11th attacks, Northern Alliance leader Ahmed Shad Massoud, who was killed 2 days before the attacks, has been presented as a friend to the United States. A New York Times piece marveled at the very limited permission given to women in Northern Alliance-held territory to study and work and wear a less restrictive covering than the burqa. The piece brushed aside the fact that many warlords of the Northern Alliance are themselves religious fighters who not only restrict women considerably when they held power from 1992 to 96, but plunged the country into civil war, compiling a record of ethnically motivated mass murder, rape, and other atrocities, and leaving the population so exhausted that the Taliban's promise of law and order came as a relief. In a series of reports condemning unqualified U.S. support of the opposition to the Taliban in Afghanistan, Human Rights Watch has warned that U.S. involvement within the struggle in Afghanistan may encourage further human rights abuses. A major report of October 5th found that throughout the civil war in Afghanistan, factions on all sides committed serious abuses and violations of international law, including killings, direct attacks on civilians, summary executions, rape, and using children as soldiers. We're joined on the telephone right now by Joost Hilterman. He is head of the Human Rights Watch Arms Division. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile.
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you lay out your report and your investigation of the Northern Alliance?
Well, it stems from a report we actually did in July that looks at the military support of the various factions in Pakistan, including the in Afghanistan, including the Taliban, and including the factions that make up the United Front, also known as the Northern Alliance. And as part of that study, we looked at the human rights record of all the parties in Afghanistan over the years. And the groups that make up the United Front don't look well at all. This is actually old news in a way, because the abuses that they committed really stem mostly from the mid-1990s, early 1990s, mid-1990s, when they were still vying for control over Kabul and the rest of the country before the Taliban came in and basically pushed them out toward the borders.
Well, old news in this day and age is very important, because the media often acts as if things are created yesterday, like the Northern Alliance. So can you talk about their record and their relationship with the current Taliban, whom they're fighting?
Well, they were created, as you will recall, hopefully, in the 1980s by the United States and others who were confronting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. This was an indigenous resistance to the occupation, but very much also a proxy force, and heavily armed, of course, through Pakistan. And they, after they succeeded in ousting the Soviets in 1989, as I said, started vying for control themselves. When the Taliban came in and made a hash of it, I mean, they committed to mass executions, mass rape. They continuously shelled whole sections of Kabul. There were a lot of ethnic targeting going on. Thousands of people were killed in this, mostly civilians. And then so the Taliban took advantage of this in many ways and brought a modicum of stability to the country, though we're not particularly popular except in sort of the areas close to Kabul and as well to Kandahar, where the majority Pashtun population lives. And the Northern Alliance was pushed on the defensive and has been, you know, has been trying to make advances, but instead has been pushed even further toward the borders of Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and Iran. And if they haven't committed any serious abuses of human rights recently, it's simply because they weren't in any position to do so. The fact is that if they were given the opportunity to revert to their old behavior, there's no reason to believe they wouldn't, because not a single commander from that period, and these were heinous abuses, not a single commander has been held accountable by the United Front for their behavior. Now they're fighting the Taliban, who are the enemy, so there's no other relationship with them. And the United States faces the challenge of, if it wants to have a post-Taliban Afghanistan that remains stable and remains, you know, beholden to U.S. interests, it will have to put together some kind of broad-based coalition that includes all of the ethnic groups, including the majority Pashtun, who are not represented in the Northern Alliance, and somehow make that work. And the challenge, the real challenge they face, is that the only armed force that is there is, in fact, this Northern Alliance and the groups making up the Northern Alliance. And they are the ones that have these warlords in their midst who have this dismal record of human rights abuse. So it's going to be quite a task.
There was an article on the inner pages of the New York Times a few days ago talking about drugs. Tony Blair has said we've got to, you know, go after the Taliban also because they provide so much of the heroin that comes into Britain. But the UNDP, the United Nations Drug Program, issued a report saying that most of the poppies are grown in the area controlled by the Northern Alliance.
I've seen those reports, too. I cannot confirm it because actually that's not my branch of work. But yes, I've seen that too, and I think that's true. Not only is the United States allying itself with with parties that have a very bad human rights record. They're also involved in other activities, including a lot of smuggling of all kinds of materials and precious metals is very problematic.
What about using children as soldiers?
Well, both sides have engaged in this practice, meaning both the Northern Alliance groups and the Taliban. They recruit children from ages 14 and 15 and start training them, and then they're put in the front lines. There hasn't been a lot of fighting, though, in the past couple of years, so you don't see a whole lot of it, but the recruitment issue is definitely there.
What do you think people in this country, because of the media and what we're being told, least understand about the Northern Alliance?
Well, I think the understanding is very limited because the understanding of Afghanistan generally is limited. The United States abandoned Afghanistan after the Soviets were driven out and after the end of the Cold War. And so there's a whole gap in our knowledge, really. And there's just a handful of experts in the West who have a thorough knowledge of Afghanistan. And so I think if the United States is able to cozy up to the Northern Alliance without any kind of questions being raised about who are included in this alliance, that is just emblematic of that. And do please keep in mind that not all of the United Front or all of the Northern Alliance is bad. I mean, there's some folks who don't have the kinds of records who were not actively involved in the mid 1990s and these kinds of abuses. But the old warlords still have a lot of power, and they are positioning themselves to come back because they smell power, basically.
Can you talk about the Leahy Law and how that bears on what you're recommending now for the U.S. and dealing with the Northern Alliance that they helped to create?
Yeah, sure. There's law in the United States that prohibits the provision of military support and training to any form of military assistance, really, to governments or to units, actually, in armed forces of countries that are involved in serious human rights abuse. And the reality still is that the Northern Alliance happens to be still the legitimate government of Afghanistan, even though they have not been in Kabul since 1996. They retain their seat in the General Assembly of the United Nations. The Taliban have never been recognized by the international community except for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Pakistan. And even those, except for Pakistan, the other two have now withdrawn their embassies. So the law applies to the former government, which is actually called the Islamic State of Afghanistan, and the head of which is Burhanuddin Rabbani. Massoud was the military leader of that alliance. And so, that being the case, we would have to pay special scrutiny to the conduct of particular units within that government, within that pseudo-government in many, or quasi-government in many ways, but of the United Front, and see which ones are the ones with the most abysmal records. And then conclusions should be drawn, and any form of military support to those units should be withheld. But not necessarily to the United Front as such. I think there should be a pick-and-choose attitude, really on the basis of past records.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Joost Halterman, for joining us. If people want to get more information on the Northern Alliance and your reports, where can they go on the web?
It's at www.hrw.org. It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Amy.
Thank you very much. And we are going to go to break now. When we come back, we're going to talk about, well, what does fast track have to do with terrorism? Why is fast track being pushed through now under the guise of the war on terrorism? And then this past weekend was the 25th anniversary of the bombing of a Cuban jetliner. As Bush fights the so-called war on terrorism abroad, why does the U.S. harbor Cuban terrorists in Miami? Stay with us. There's a war going on out there. There's a war going on out there. There's a war going on. Kevin So, who was live with us just a few days ago here at the Firehouse, singing now on CD. I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report as we broadcast just blocks from where the towers of World Trade Center once stood, and the fire still burns there, and we smell that burning every day. In a piece called Trading on Tragedy, Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research writes, "Every crisis and tragedy is an opportunity for some, as any ambulance-chasing lawyer can tell you. We expect the Pentagon to lord its already bloated budget and Attorney General John Ashcroft to chip away at the Bill of Rights, all in the name of the war against terrorism. But trade promotion authority? That seems like quite a stretch. Yet, that's exactly what happened. Trade Promotion Authority, or Fast Track, would give the administration power to negotiate new international commercial agreements, with Congress having only a yes or no vote on the final product. First in line is the controversial 34-country Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick has framed the issue of free trade in terms of national security. He asks, will the Congress strongly support free trade as a cornerstone of international leadership? The answer depends on where Congress chooses to look. A recent poll by the University of Maryland showed that 72% believe that U.S. officials who make trade policy give too little consideration to the concerns of working Americans. Critics say the bill offers watered-down language on protecting workers' rights and the environment in an attempt to win over the support of Democrats. Well, last night, Fast Track passed through the House Ways and Means Committee. The chair of the committee, Bill Thomas of California, seemed especially interested in jump-starting the bill in the House. It has been presented as a bipartisan compromise and will appear on the floor of Congress for a vote next week. Now, Democracy Now! in Exile set up a debate with the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative and Lori Wallach of Public Citizen, but a few moments ago, the Office of the Trade Representative canceled. So we are joined by Lori Wallach of Public Citizen and David Amdur, Program Director of CISPACE, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. Welcome you both.
Thank
to
you.
The War and Peace Report. Lori Wallach, what does Fast Track have to do with war and peace?
Well, right now you've got a set of Republican congressmen who, frankly, are trying to politically profiteer on a new mood of bipartisanship in Congress to ram through a controversial trade proposal that has nothing to do with either the security issues, the rebuilding of people's lives and jobs and homes, the important work of trying to get the economy going again, to get working people some comfort for all the millions who've in the short term been laid off and in the longer term have been struggling. All of those urgent items, in fact, are getting sidelined. And the good news about that is members of Congress are getting really mad because this stunt to try and use this moment to revive what has been a piece of controversial, nasty, NAFTA-expanding legislation that has been stuck for 7 years because of its problems, to try and revive it, members are getting really mad. And they're saying, my constituents want me to be dealing with making sure, you know, their community is safe, or making sure that, you know, these folks in the entertainment or airline industry have some safety net, their health care doesn't run off. What the heck am I having to do with Fast Track? And so that's the upside. The downside is that this handful of Republican leaders, including the chairman of the Trade Committee, plus the United States Trade Representative, Zoellick, are on a mission that you cannot imagine of narrow-sighted self-centeredness and energy to try and push this bill onto the floor with all the consequences of wasting time, of displacing things that need to be done, and also, frankly, of causing a huge partisan knockdown dragout that could undermine the stuff that does need to get done, like extending unemployment and health care benefits for all the people in the hotel and airline industry who are totally stuck today.
David Amdur, you're with the Committee in Solidarity of the People of El Salvador. In our first hour, we were looking at the FBI looking at women in black. Now, CISPACE has been a target of the FBI in the 1980s, and maybe I'll ask you about that in a minute if you're concerned about the same thing happening now. But you're focusing on Fast Track now. Why?
We're focusing on Fast Track because as a solidarity organization, people in Latin America, especially in El Salvador, have told us that FTA will only exacerbate the misery, poverty, and exploitation that the neoliberal model has already been imposing in Latin America. And we see Fast Track as, defeating Fast Track as a key way in stopping FTA. And I think Lori's comments are incredibly valid, but if we look into Latin America, there is rising discontent, and there is an administration, the Bush administration, which wants to further implement its neoliberal program and is taking rank advantage of September 11th to push ahead that agenda. And as Lori said, is using the war on terrorism, up to Robert Zoellick accusing the anti-globalization movement of being terrorists.
Explain what you mean.
I think there have been various comments that Zoellick has made, which he has insinuated that anti-globalization protesters are terrorists. I saw a comment where he linked anti-globalization protesters to the Black Hand anarchists of the early 20th century, and I think it's nothing more than an attempt to associate people who oppose Fast Track and government policies with being terrorists, and that is a very disturbing and very frightening thing.
Lori Wallach, I think we had you on right after Zoellick had given one of those speeches as they link the World Trade Center with the issue of world trade.
Mr. Zoellick has said some of the most offensive and outrageous things imaginable. The speeches would be fun reading if it weren't so serious. The only upside to this offensive assault on all of our integrity, because, yes, he suggests that any anti-globalization protester is effectively a terrorist, but he also goes on to say that any member of Congress who doesn't support his fast-track bill is for the is in favor of those who have attacked the country and is an unpatriotic person. And the upside of this crassness is a variety of particularly Democrats have gotten very upset with that kind of a broad brush attack on any kind of dissent, on any arguments about how or under what rules globalization should be steered. And as a result, and this is what folks listening who care about this can do, as a result, there's a whole array of Democrats in Congress who typically would not be as sympathetic or as progressive about a trade issue as one would hope, who are newly outraged, susceptible to doing the right thing, and now need to be lined up to vote against the Thomas bill, which, Amy, as you said, could be on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives as soon as next week. And the game here is, right now, the bad guys don't have the votes. They're bluffing. But at the moment, they have the votes. They will try and wrap this piece of sewage in a flag and run it through Congress. And the way that we stop that is we make sure we all speak to our members of Congress and get them out publicly against both this attempt to move this self-interested piece of legislation now, thus interrupting all the things that Congress really needs to deal with, plus the idea of substantively this backwards, anti-people, pro-neoliberal agenda of ramming more of the IMF, World Bank, WTO policies on developing countries using this tool. And particularly for Democrats, if you're in a congressional district that's represented by a Democrat, they're really bummed out by Zoellick smearing them all. And the good news is, basically, you can, if you've never called Congress before, but you are represented by a Democrat, today is the day. And in fact, every day for the next week until we actually get this fast track boxed and buried. And it's very easy. You can just call the Capitol switchboard, give them your zip code. If you're not sure who your member of Congress is, they'll connect you right to the office. It's not that expensive. And you just need to tell them, vote, come out today publicly against this Thomas fast track. It's offensive to do it now. It's a bad bill. I want you to be against.
David Amdor of CISPACE.
And that number is 202-224-3121. And I would really emphasize Lori's thing. Call Congress. Call them now. They need as much pressure as they can.
Mm-hmm. On the issue of the U.S. going around the world and trying to bring together people in this coalition, in this so-called war on terrorism, let me ask either of you, if you know what deals are being made in terms of trade.
In Central America and El Salvador, the Salvadoran government, which has been a key ally of the United States going back into the 1980s, is now the sort of point for implementing the neoliberal model in Central America and also implementing a national security doctrine. In El Salvador, 10 days after September 11th, over 300 airport workers were fired after the FAA made a snap investigation, went to the Comalapa International Airport, declared it unsecure, and the Salvadoran government took that, and as Bush and Zolik are pushing through fast track, they did that to fire the workers because for a number of years there's been a plan to privatize the airport and the seaport in El Salvador, and it's nothing more than pushing ahead their right-wing agenda. And also in Central America, there have been meetings between Central American militaries and police forces to coordinate a war on terrorism. And I think especially most disturbing, the southern border of Mexico and Guatemala is being very heavily militarized, both to check the flow of people who are leaving Central America because there is no economic opportunity because of the neoliberal model, and to prevent what will most likely be social explosions. There is a devastating drought in Central America, and people are already dying of hunger in Guatemala and Honduras. And if Fast Track is approved and that facilitates FTA, I think we're going to see Central America go down a very bad road.
Lori Wallach.
What we've seen is different promises of more access for products from certain key countries. For instance, there has been a national security related to the non-proliferation treaty, a ban or a limit on trade with Pakistan because Pakistan was selling assorted weapons that it had agreed it wouldn't to assorted rogue nations, as they put it. And the result of lifting the ban now is that Pakistan can send more things here and the U.S. companies can send more things there. Similarly, different countries have been given just in the short term more access, particularly for imports of clothing and textiles, to try and get countries to join the alliance. The thing that is interesting about it is, in a way, the fact that this is going on totally disproves this notion that Fast Track is somehow a necessary tool to gain allies in the so-called fight on terrorism, which is what Zelik in his calmer moments actually gets down to when he tries to make the link. In fact, the U.S. without Fast Track has gone about making these kind of arrangements, and in fact, last week in the Senate, the U.S.-Jordan Free Trade Agreement, negotiated without Fast Track, passed without Fast Track, put through quickly because the U.S. wanted to give a gift to Jordan and to show other countries in the region the economic benefits of cooperating. That agreement was done with no Fast Track, no problem, as have all these other deals been done. So to the extent that you run into a member of Congress when you're making your calls, which you could think of like meals, three times a day, good time to call Congress. When you're calling your members of Congress, if they say, oh, this has to be done, of course, we've seen as a reality what's happened in the last month, that all of these arrangements have been made with no Fast Track.
I think you need to tell Congress that it's not inevitable. And if we look, Fast Track was defeated twice in 97 and 98. And I think, as Lori said, use any argument, but especially use the argument that it will facilitate economic policies that will sow misery, exploitation, and death in Central America and Latin America through FTAA. And if we're really concerned about national security, we will, with the passage of Fast Track and facilitating FTAA, we'll be creating a climate of insecurity in all of Latin America.
David, as we're just blocks from the World Trade Center site, an unrelated question, perhaps related in some way. Do you know about Salvadoran workers who may have died in the World Trade Center attack?
We have varying information. I've seen things that speak of possibly 100. The Salvadoran press, I think, has spoken of at least 10. And I think, as you said earlier, we may never know how many immigrants, Salvadoran immigrants, Mexican, Ecuadorian died. I think also in the Salvadoran immigrant community and in the community, especially here in New York City, there's a great deal of fear. I mean, just walking down here today from the subway, I saw the police stopping two vehicles. One of them was a group of African Americans, the other was a group of Latinos, and they were giving them the most heavy, intense question. And in the immigrant communities, there is a real fear because there's a message that there is an enemy within, and it's terrorism, and it's Arabs, it's Muslims, it's people with brown skin, it's people with black skin.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Lori Wallach of Public Citizen and David Amder, Program Director at CISSPACE, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. And before we move to our last segment, where we're going to be looking at terrorism, this is the 25th anniversary of the downing of a Cuban jetliner. Almost all of the fencing team was killed in that explosion. Those that are responsible live here in the United States. I wanted to look for a minute about the information that we're getting. Tomorrow on the War and Peace Report, we're going to look at a report that was put out by the General Accounting Office a couple of years ago that talked about the targets during the Persian Gulf War and how few, in fact, were hit, that the majority of missile attacks that were launched by the United States did not hit their mark, leading, of course, to high number of civilian deaths. But now we see on the front page of the Washington Post an article saying a dispute over the Bush administration's control of information since the September 11th terrorist strikes erupted into an angry exchange between the White House and Congress yesterday after President Bush moved to restrict intelligence sharing with lawmakers. Members from both parties objected strongly to Bush's highly unusual step of ordering that briefings with sensitive information be limited to 8 of the 535 members of Congress. The memo cuts off numerous lawmakers cleared to receive classified information. It was signed by Bush Friday following a report in the Washington Post that intelligence officials told lawmakers there was 100% likelihood of further terrorist strikes. We're joined now by Peter Hart, who is with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Lawmakers are vowing to press the issue in a leadership meeting with Bush at the White House today. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Peter.
My pleasure.
Well, what about this latest crackdown on information?
Yeah, there's very little information that's being shared with the public. So to crack down on it, you kind of wonder what exactly they're going to be cracking down on. We do know that journalists knew, for example, on Friday, select handful of journalists, that the attacks were imminent, and yet you could only get some basic clues about that in the coverage leading up to Sunday's air attacks. So there is some information that's being shared and being filtered down to journalists. Journalists are not sharing that with the public, so it's hard to say what exactly they're clamping down on at this point, since we're relatively in the dark here.
I was watching CNN early this morning. It was quite interesting, one story after another about censorship, but it was being applauded by the, if you can call them, news anchors. One was saying that the Washington Post had agreed not to publish some information on Friday when the Bush administration approached the newspaper and to ask them not to publish it. And the other was about this videotape that has been released that's of the spokesperson for Osama bin Laden. And they showed a picture of the videotape, and they said, but we are not going to air this here because the administration has told us that they're concerned that there are hidden messages in this videotape that would be some kind of green light to terrorists to launch more attacks. And I'm wondering what your comment on this is, whether it's the some kind of covert message that they're concerned about or the actual overt message, and what happened on Sunday when first you saw the Bush videotape of his announcement that the bombs were dropping on Afghanistan with U.S. and British pilots at the helm, and then the videotape of Osama bin Laden, and this videotape being aired throughout the day of his statement, and then being printed in newspapers juxtaposed against Bush's all over the Arab world. Is that simply what they're trying to stop?
Yeah, it's hard to say. This is a developing story. We know this morning, probably as we speak, there are network executives that are meeting with Condoleezza Rice, and they're, you know, in a sense, consulting with her about what they can and cannot broadcast, and whether or not statements from bin Laden's people are going to be acceptable to air on their networks. This is an absurd idea for journalists to go to their own government and consult over whether or not some statements are acceptable to air. We know, you know, if you've watched any of the coverage, the anchors themselves are kind of pained to even look at this stuff, and they some of them even partly apologize for airing it. What's responsible for journalists to do is to air that and to talk about it, to talk about what's being said. I think on Sunday when the statements from bin Laden were aired, it did give people a chance to at least hear what his message to the world was. And if we're going to understand world events, we're going to need to look at this, at these tapes. We're going to need to read these statements and evaluate them. But I think you're right. I think it's the overt message, just hearing from him at all, that the White House and the Bush administration is concerned about.
You also have the story of the Bush administration, the State Department, putting pressure on the Al Jazeera network based in Qatar. This was before the Osama bin Laden videotape was delivered to them. They broadcast it. Then CNN saying they had an exclusive relationship with Al Jazeera, broadcast what they broadcast.
Yeah, this is, you know, some people say this is probably the freest media in the Arab world, and the State Department is working to try to silence it or to clamp down on it somehow, which really goes to show you what the purpose here is. It's the Al Jazeera is an organ that at the very least can get a hold of these tapes and air them, and they're seen throughout the Arab world. And that, for some reason, is what worries the State Department. So it is our window as American viewers. It is our window into what they're saying and what they're talking about and what their media looks like. And I think it's important for us to have that access.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. People can go to the site and see their latest media criticism at fair.org. There's a quote of a Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, who is responding to the admonition of President Bush about giving out intelligence information in Congress. And Hagel says, to put out a public document telling the world he doesn't trust the Congress and we leak everything, I'm not sure that helps develop unanimity and comradeship. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to talk about terrorism. We're going to talk about this 25th anniversary of the downing of the bombing of a Cuban jetliner. Those who did it are here in the United States. Almost the whole Cuban fencing team was killed, along with a number of other people. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report as we continue to break the sound barrier with this unprecedented collaboration of public media on the internet, on public access television, and on radio stations around the country, as well as satellite TV through Free Speech TV's Dish Network. As the Bush administration wages its so-called war against terrorism, U.S. officials have said repeatedly that the U.S. may attack any country harboring or supporting terrorists and that there's no statute of limitations when it comes to prosecuting them. Bush administration officials might want to look a bit closer to home, say, in Miami. This weekend was the 25th anniversary of another act of terrorism, the bombing of a Cuban jetliner carrying nearly 100 people, including Cuba's Olympic medal-winning fencing team. The men responsible for the act of terrorism were Cuban exiles trained by the CIA based in Miami's hardline Cuban exile community. Their story and their connection to U.S. officials tells a lot about the priorities of the Bush administration and the U.S. government when it comes to fighting terrorism. Wayne Smith is our guest. He's with the Center for International Policy, leading expert on Cuba, was the U.S. diplomat in Cuba for 25 years in Moscow, Havana, and elsewhere. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
No, a pleasure to be with you. Let me correct. I wasn't in Cuba 25 years.
Right.
I was there 3 years the first time from 58 to 61 when we broke relations, and then 3 years from 79 to 82. But most of my career in one way or another did have to do with Cuba. Even when I was in Moscow, I followed Soviet-Cuban affairs.
Well, can you tell us the story of the downing of this Cuban jetliner?
Yes, it was. It was bombed. Bombs were placed aboard. It took off from Barbados, just off the east coast of South America. Exploded in midair. The pilots tried to get back, but could not, and it crashed, killing everyone aboard. Almost 100 people. Many of them young Cuban athletes, including almost the entire fencing team. Now, Orlando Bosch, a Cuban exile who had served time in jail in Miami before for terrorist acts, was on parole in 1974 and violated that parole, went to Latin America, ended up in Venezuela. He was arrested for masterminding the bombing. He and another Cuban exile, Luis Posada Carriles, who had also been involved in terrorist activities in Miami against Cuba and anyone in Miami who disagreed with the hardline exiles. Orlando Bosch was released under strange circumstances in 1986, or perhaps it was 87, and at that point, the American ambassador in Caracas initiated the process of trying to get him a visa to come back to the United States. I mean, the guy is out on parole, and he has been serving time for a terrorist act, but the American ambassador is trying to get him a visa so he can return to the States. Orlando Bosch did not wait. He returned on his own, entered surreptitiously, and was arrested and was up for deportation. But, of course, the exiles began to raise all kinds of alarms over that. He was, to them, he was a hero. Miami had had the Miami City Commission had declared in 1983 a Dr. Orlando Bosch Day to honor him, presumably to honor him for an act of terror in downing this plane. In any event, the Justice Department took a very strong stand against allowing Orlando Bosch to remain. The assistant attorney general said that if we harbored terrorists such as Bosch, we would lose all credibility in trying to persuade other countries not to harbor terrorists and bombers. But the influence of the hardline Cuban exiles and politicians in Miami was sufficient so that the first Bush administration granted Bush his parole and eventually pardoned him altogether. So he has lived freely and honored in Miami ever since. The other exile involved, Luis Posada Carriles, escaped from prison in Venezuela. There was a charge, not substantiated, that he escaped as a result of a bribe paid by the Cuban American National Foundation. He subsequently, back in the States, became involved in other terrorist activities, and in 1997 masterminded the bombing of Cuban tourist hotels with the loss of at least one life, an Italian tourist who died. He confessed this in an interview with the New York Times. Yes, he had masterminded it, and he had been financed by the Cuban American National Foundation. They denied it and said they'd sue, but the New York Times had it all on tape, so they never did sue.
I was in Cuba soon after that, and the father of the Italian tourist at the hotel sat every day in the corner near where his son was when he was killed.
Yeah, well, it was absolutely unconscionable, and no charges were ever filed against Luis Posada Carriles. Now, what does all this have to do with the situation today? Well, the man who was the American ambassador in Caracas back in 1988 and who initiated the process of trying to get Orlando Bosch, the terrorist, a visa to return to the United States was none other than Otto Reich, who is now President Bush's nominee to be Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs. He was then, remains, a very close associate of the Cuban-American National Foundation and various others in the Miami community who have in the past, in the very recent past, because we're talking about 1997-1998, have supported and endorsed terrorism. This would send exactly the wrong signal to the other nations of the world. Here we're trying to convince people they should not harbor terrorists, and we're going to make Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs a man who has been associated with those who've supported terrorists.
And where does Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, the brother of the president, fit into this
picture? Jeb Bush was one of those who, back in 1988 and 1990, was lobbying, urging the Bush administration to pardon, first to parole Orlando Bosch so that he could remain in the United States, and then to pardon him. And they won. They had enough influence with the Bush administration that they succeeded. It's often said that the present President Bush could not do anything to offend the hardline Cuban exiles because that might have some, jeopardize the chances that Jeb Bush could be reelected as governor of Florida. I think that's utter nonsense. For whom would the hardline exiles vote if they didn't vote for Jeb Bush? Would they vote for Janet Reno? Not likely. So there's no risk involved, no domestic political risk involved in taking a firm stand against terrorism emanating from Miami and taking a position against having anyone in the government who has endorsed such tactics or who has given aid and comfort to those who have committed them. And if we make Otto Reich the Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, it will have the opposite effect.
Of course, he would join the other two who have been approved, most recently John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, spearheading the coalition to bomb Afghanistan, who is Ambassador to Honduras and accused of being involved
with
death squads there and supporting them as a mm-hmm. U.S. official. And then, of course, Elliot Abrams. Who was also has moved into the National Security
it's
Council.
It's an unsavory group at best.
Cuba remains on the State Department's list of states that sponsor terrorism. Is there any concern that the U.S. is going to bomb Cuba?
No, I don't think that they would do that. Not even the Bush administration is wild enough to do that or so committed. Let me rephrase that. Not even the Bush administration is so committed to the hardline exiles that they're likely to do that. On the other hand, I don't see them taking the step that they should take and to remove Cuba from the list of terrorist nations, because there's no reason for it to be there. I mean, the State Department says it's harboring Basque terrorists. Well, that's nonsense. There are some old ETA members, Basque separatists, living in Cuba, but they're there as a result of an agreement between the Spanish government and the Cuban government. Spain is not complaining about them being there at all. No, it prefers that they remain there. So that's no reason to have them on the list. They also say there are some American fugitives in Cuba. There are, but that's because there's no extradition treaty. That's another reason to move towards normalization. Let's negotiate an extradition treaty. And finally, that Cuba has had contact with the guerrillas in Colombia and facilitated meetings between them and the Colombian government. Well, they have, but so have we. We've had contact with those guerrilla groups and have facilitated peace talks and meetings between them and the Colombian government. Mexico has had a hand in that. So has Venezuela and a number of other countries. That's no reason to have a nation on the terrorist list. Well, Cuba and the world changed September the 11th. Cuba has taken a position categorically against terrorism and stated that it will cooperate with all nations and certainly with the UN in efforts against terrorism.
Well, Wayne Smith, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us.
Okay.
With the Center
so
for
we should engage
International
them
Policy.
Rather than trying to isolate them.
Thank you, U.S. diplomat in Cuba for 6 years and about the time that Castro came to power in Cuba. And that does it for today's program. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland's at WBIX.org, where you can hear this program live. You can also hear us on the internet at democracynow.org or webactive.com. Thanks to Amy Pomerleau and Aaron Glantz at KPFA and Free Speech Radio News. Thanks to everyone there and at affiliate station KFCF and to all the affiliate stations. We are Pacifica. Special thanks to our tech team at New York Independent Media Center and Downtown Community Television. We're in exile from the studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.